Like other states across the country, Oregon is struggling with the question of how to fund higher education in a time of shrinking budgets. Portland State University, or PSU, has increased class sizes and made deep cuts to student programs and teacher pay. But recently, PSU's president proposed a new model to solve the university's budget woes, incorporation. From station KBOO, Jenka Soderberg has more.
Portland State University is a bustling urban campus located in downtown Portland, Oregon. The students here are mainly a commuter population, and the campus is hardly a hotbed of student activism. But when University President Vim Vivel went public with his proposal to address the university's budget woes, students started organizing to oppose what they call a privatization scheme.
We have the power!
We have the power!
President Vivel's restructuring plan has two major components: call on the state to set minimum funding requirements for all public universities, and turn the university into a public corporation. The latter is what's rocking the boat. At a rally outside the student union one Friday afternoon, more than 75 students gathered to say no to the proposed restructuring. Student Wael El-Assadi was one of the organizers of the protest.
This is not a solution for the financial challenges facing our higher education. We do not need a Wall Street exotic formula of leveraging debt enacted by an unaccountable board of directors to fix our education system.
But President Vivel stands firm. Over the last 20 years, public funding for higher ed in Oregon has dropped 44%, while public safety and prison spending has gone up by 50%. The result? Increased tuition costs by almost a quarter for each student. Vivel says drastic times need drastic measures and believes incorporation is the only way to ensure a stable funding base for PSU. But Jonathan Sanford, PSU's student body president, sees it another way.
Why isn't he going to D.C. and saying, damn it, we need more teachers in our classrooms. Damn it, we need to pay our teachers more. Damn it, our students need to have enough funding.
President Vivel cites Oregon Health and Science University as a success story. OHSU incorporated 15 years ago. This year, it's facing a $30 million budget shortfall, and students are certain to pick up the remaining tab. PSU students worry the same will happen to them. But Oregon State Board of Higher Education Vice President Jim Francesconi says students and opponents of privatizing don't have to worry.
I think it's fair to say that the university president would like the ability to raise tuition. And we haven't yet decided how that's going to work out. I suspect that there will be some guidelines placed upon it, if not by the legislature, by the board. But it's an issue that needs a lot of discussion with the students, with the faculty, with all the stakeholders, and then eventually by the legislature and the board.
Right now, Oregon's public universities are bound to state-legislated tuition caps. PSU in-state students pay $6,400 a year in tuition and fees. Without those state caps, they say shortfalls in funding are sure to hit their pocketbooks. But they say it's not entirely about the money. Students say incorporating PSU will also change its overall character and mission. Opening its doors in 1945, Portland State University's origins are rooted in the city's Black community. Catering at first to World War II vets, it quickly gained a reputation as the People's University within the Oregon State University system, and was known for its open admission process and inclusion of minority communities. Student activists like Zaki Bucharest worry incorporating will change that.
As far as I'm concerned, when you allow an institution to fall between the cracks of financial stress to the point of restructuring is nothing but an acknowledgement of a high level of financial mismanagement. The continual system of accruing debt and credit lines and requests for debt forgiveness has been allowing administration of universities, including our own, to follow up in cleaning house for specialty programs. Cleaning houses and kicking them out and consolidating them, such as Black Studies, Chicano Latino Studies, Native American Studies, and Women's Studies, or programs that do not produce revenue for the university.
While incorporation of Oregon's state universities is one option for dealing with the budget crisis, it's not the only proposal on the table. Some administrators have brought up the possibility of turning Oregon universities into a system like the University of California, where tuition forms the main basis of funding. That way, legislators can't cap tuition as they do in Oregon. But student activists have taken a different sort of inspiration from what's happening in California. Adam Sanchez is a PSU graduate student and a primary school teacher.
We've seen the largest and the deepest cuts in California, and thankfully they've been met with one of the strongest movements to defend public education that we've seen in this country, I think, since the 1960s. But I think we have to spread that now outside of California.
Meanwhile, PSU students say they will continue to organize protests and lobby state legislators. A decision on PSU's restructuring proposal could be approved by the state legislature as early as April. If approved, PSU students and opponents of incorporation fear the university's focus will shift from quality and accountability to profitability. For Making Contact, I'm Jenka Soderberg, Portland, Oregon.
We gotta build towards that day to support the students in California, because we're facing the same cuts here. Yeah!
From raising fees to incorporating entire universities, there are many ways universities nationwide are being privatized. As we heard earlier in the show, California's public education system has been eroding for decades, and some say it's being dismantled by design. Christopher Newfield wrote a whole book about it. He's a professor of English at the University of California, Santa Barbara campus, and author of Unmaking the Public University, The 40-Year Assault on the Middle Class. Our producer, Tina Rubio, recently spoke with Professor Newfield.
In this show, we actually profiled a couple of different ways education is being privatized. On the face of it, privatizing our educational system might seem like a good idea to some, but in your opinion, is it?
No. The great contribution of low-cost public higher education was mass access to high quality. That was the secret formula of the University of California and in a different way of Cal State. And by that I mean that you would have a campus, you know, that is starting with Berkeley and then expanding throughout the system, where you had cutting-edge research, where you had internationally renowned scholars, you had some of the most amazing thinking, the best poets, the best scientists, et cetera, working, and then the children of farm workers and the children of factory workers would go to lectures and have those folks grading their papers. I mean, that was the vision, to have this contact between every element of society such that people that were first-generation college educated, were immigrants, were low income, had access to the best that society had to offer. The best was not just reserved for a tiny elite. When everybody has to pay, stratification increases, and the best gets reserved for a much smaller group. You see, all around the world, there are fabulous universities for 1% or 2% of the population. The California secret was to have that for 12%, and then with Cal State for 33%, and access through the community college transfer system for 100% of people who wanted to go on after high school.
Let's talk a little bit about after graduation. So two-thirds of four-year college graduates leave with loan debt averaging about $23,000. That number is likely to increase if students can't get the courses they need to graduate on time. So we're hearing that some students might have to stay 5, maybe 6 years. What implications does that have in terms of the choices students or people will have to make after they graduate?
Well, it means that they have to take any job they can get. It means that people will move out of socially valuable but lower paying jobs like teaching and social work and nursing and move into jobs that pay more. If somebody goes to law school and they graduate with, you know, $200,000 in debt, it means they will work in corporate law firms rather than working on, you know, sexuality issues for, you know, $58,000 a year. They literally can't keep a roof over their head and pay their loans at the same time. So it's a loss to society. It's a loss to the social value that is created by people who are not as well paid as, you know, as folks in business, et cetera, but who do something that everybody needs. So I think the California public is less aware of what it gets from basically medium paid as well as low paid labor.
And what do you think would happen if this country privatized their education?
We would lower the rate of college attainment, and we would become more ignorant than we already are. We would fall behind economically. We would have more social conflict. We would have less social understanding. All these things are already happening. In California, the state fell from fifth in the nation to 47th in 8 years between 1996 and 2004. In the rate of the college continuation, that is, whether you not only start college but actually finish it, which is, of course, the crucial index of how you fare later on. We don't have an obvious direct causal connection between rising fees and that decline in educational attainment, but they did happen at the same time. There's a strong likelihood of a correlation.
Well, in light of our current cuts to higher ed taking place across the country, what potential scenarios do you see for the future?
In the short term, I think that the Obama administration is going to pour the lion's share of money into bank rescues and wars in the Middle East. So I'm not really that optimistic in the short run. The higher education leadership in California has asked for direct operating funds to come from the federal government in partnership with the states. That's not going to happen, I don't think, because the federal government is now moving towards a commitment for supporting student fees through Pell Grants and the expansion of similar programs. So I think the short term is blocked. I think the medium term people are going to have to become much more active in defining the kind of society that they want, and where education is a central part of that. There's a good, you know, grassroots network that's already was put in place by the Obama administration. There's a lot of skill out there around internet organizing and face-to-face organizing. And I think that we actually, in 2009, a major change took place, which is that for the first time in my adult lifetime, everybody figured out that cuts to public funding lower quality. People didn't know that before, and elements in UC's administration had denied that that was the case in order to, you know, reassure contributors, both corporate and individual philanthropists, that quality was very high and they were giving money to a good thing. That's understandable that they would do that, but it misled the public. And I think finally we have the foundation for saying, look, if you want the kind of golden age that we had before, any simulacra of that, of greater social peace and understanding, greater cultural productivity and enlightenment in the old sense, and economic growth of the old kind, you have to invest in higher education for the future. My hope is that people know this now and that they're going to restore and rebuild public higher education, continue to grow it, bring in folks that are currently shut out in much higher proportions, Latinos and African Americans in California in particular, and they will get back on track. You know, we were on a good path in the 60s and 70s around these issues, and we forgot some of the gains that we made. They were incomplete, but they were good. And so I just see a lot of not return, but a kind of a reimagination of where we can go happening in the next few years.
And Chris, is there anything that I left out that you'd like to add?
I mean, here's another piece of this that I think is really important. When you have mass education, you can't get feedback and skill training in the way that you get if, say, you're trying to become a ballet dancer or a musician or a photographer. You know, if you go to art school, there's a kind of a craft relationship that is increasingly not present for undergraduates in large state universities. And what that means is that they basically have to teach themselves. And, it, you know, it's much more like online education, which is good in a lot of ways, but you don't get sort of detailed hands-on instruction. That's what people get at expensive private schools. They get seminars with 10 people. They get their papers graded once a week. They get every sentence corrected if that's what they need. I want that for everybody in the society, not a fragmented society in which a small percentage gets that and everyone else just has to shift for themselves. We'll figure out how to pay for it. We can use technology to do it. But the explosion of, you know, creativity and imagination that would take place if all of this talent, or a high percentage of this talent, were not left by the side of the road would be just extraordinary and would more than pay for whatever extra money we put into it.
That was Christopher Newfield, professor at UC Santa Barbara and author of Unmaking the Public University, The 40-Year Assault on the Middle Class. He spoke with Making Contact producer Tina Rubio. And that's it for this special edition of Making Contact. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or check out our website at radioproject.org to get our podcast, download past shows, or help make a difference by supporting our work. Making Contact is supported by listeners like you. You allow us to continue to offer our programming for free to radio stations across the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. Thank you. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Tina Rubio executive producer, Pauline Bartoloni is our producer and online editor, Andrew Stelzer producer, CONFAM associate director, Daphne Young station relations, Elena Daigle, Rashida Harmon, and Joaquin Palomino are interns, and Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, Jen Gordon, Alton Bird, Alfonso Hooker are volunteers. And I'm Sandina Robbins. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.